So it's a fact of modern life that we all have lots of stuff. I used to live in a bungalow built in the 1920s that had two small closets. They were walk-in closets because you could actually walk into them, but that was about it. And reading in preparation for this service, I learned that people at the turn of the century didn't have much storage because they didn't have many things. Humans have a very complicated relationship with our objects, obviously, because there are some people even who rent storage units to hold the stuff that doesn't fit in their house. So objects can play, we can relate to objects in three basic ways. Having stuff gives us a sense of security and often a sense of self. There's a lot of signaling that goes on with our stuff, sometimes signaling our status, wearing designer label clothes, unless, of course, you bought them at TJ Maxx, or driving a Prius can make a statement about what you value, protecting the earth. Objects also serve as tools for us. You can imagine in your life many things that function as a tool. The one that came to me mostly was my smartphone. I'm very attached to my smartphone. It is an important tool in my life. But when I upgrade to another one, I'm not going to have a memorial service for the one that is being replaced. I'm not attached to it in a sentimental way. It's an important tool in my life. So when it gets really complicated is when we have attachment to our things, especially when our things have sentimental value. When objects represent a connection to another person, usually it's someone that we're close to, maybe someone who's died, someone that we have positive associations with. An object could be associated with a memory. That's the shirt I wore the night we decided to get married. Our childhood teddy bears function in this way. Psychologists call the teddy bear experience, they call it a transitional object. Your parents leave you to sleep in your own room, but the teddy bear represents the safety and security of your parents. However, those teddy bears can become sentimental objects when we take them away to college, for example, or when we still have them when we're in our later years. The connection between our feelings and the object often has a physical component to it, and anthropologists call it a contagion. It was touched by something, and that touch itself has power. This is like why things that celebrities owned sell for a ton of money on eBay. President John Kennedy's tape measure sold for $48,000 on eBay because it had been touched by Kennedy. Sentimental value is particularly attached to things that people we've loved who've died, that we own these things that they have touched, that have been a part of their life. Myself, I have a museum to my grandmother, Adele. I have her bedside lamp, her hair combs, a large spoon, a washboard. I have a knitted vest she wore when she came to America. I have her box of sewing supplies and her prayer book. Having these items makes me feel closer to her. And it does matter to me that these are items that she used and that she touched. As I worked on this service, I was fully aware that there were thousands of people not far from us who have lost everything. Everything. It's really hard to imagine unless it has happened to you. I had a fire in my bedroom when I was 10 years old. It didn't burn down my family's home, but it burned down everything that I owned. And I still remember the emotion. It's not difficult for me to bring up the emotion of watching my beloved stuffed animals, my toys, everything I owned going away. There's an artist who developed a project called the Burning House Project. And he posed a question to people, said, if your house was burning, what would you take with you? For most folks, it's a conflict between what's practical, what's valuable, and what's sentimental. And behind me on the screen is one of the, people take pictures of these and it's posted. So if you're interested, just go to Burning House and you'll see hundreds of people that are participating in this project. This person whose stuff is behind me here is from Belgium. She's 58 years old and she's a nanny. She would take her first handmade quilt, box with old family pictures, her father's shaving bowl, her mother's watch, a teddy bear that her brother gave her when she was very sick at the age of 10, her parents' wedding registry book, and her favorite book. Pretty much all sentimental items. Can I have the next slide, Colleen? This is a fellow from Lisbon, Portugal, 33 years old. Different mix of things here. He's got his cell phone, his computer, his car keys, which I find kind of interesting. But he does have his grandfather's camera and his lucky small toys. This is what he would take if he had to leave a burning house. What would you take? As you ponder this question, we're going to hear three reflections this morning about the meaning of stuff in our lives. But before we start that, Keith is going to share a song with us about the Names Project. Some of you will remember that project honoring people who died of AIDS. Individual quilt squares were made in honor of someone who had died, and they often contained something that belonged to the person woven into the square. Fabric from clothing they wore, a lock of hair, photos, a feather boa, or parts of a Halloween costume. And you'll see some samples as Keith shares with us the song.
They unfolded your lives one by one. They laid out your patchwork under the sun. And people gathered from miles around to witness your life spread on the ground. And then they called out your names. Oh, yes, they called out your names. And you will live forever. Know that I'll be loving you just like a patchwork quilt. Well, there were men and women, mothers and fathers, sisters and brothers, daughters and sons, and children and babies and lovers and friends. They all lay before me, sewn into one. And then they call out your names. Oh, yes, they call out your names. And you will live forever. Know that I'll be loving you just like a patchwork quilt. Your lives had meaning and your lives had joy. You touch so many people, many more than you'll know. And you wrap yourselves around me as I walk along these rows. You're letting me see your beautiful souls. And then they called out your names. Oh, yes, they called out your names. And you will live forever. Know that I'll be loving you just like a patchwork quilt. Your lives had meaning and your lives had joy. You touched so many people, many more than you'll know. And you wrap yourselves around me as I walk along these rows. You're letting me see your beautiful souls. I feel the warmth of your lives. I feel the warmth of your lives. And you will live forever. Know that I'll be loving you just like a patchwork quilt. My heart spills over, flowing with tears. I cry for your suffering and for your shortened years. And I'll take you with me as I walk away, remembering you who died with AIDS. I will remember your names. Yes, I'll remember your names. And you will live forever. Know that we'll be loving you just like a patchwork quilt. Know that we'll remember you just like a patchwork quilt.
I've always been a minimalist when it comes to possessions. Perhaps I was a nomad in a past life and needed to be ready to travel light. In any case, I detest clutter and love organization, a place for everything and everything in its place, preferably in a see-through tote. I am very sentimental. Just ask my family, especially my children, about the times I teared up during award ceremonies, coming-of-age rituals, graduations, and don't even ask about weddings and babies. Events, yes. Things, not so much. Except for the 4 large totes of every card or letter I had ever received. Yes, I had kept every single one. After Dan and I decided to move from Pennsylvania to California, I needed to go through those cards and letters. I chose to keep everything from family and to get rid of the rest. But before I did, I would look at every single one. For those of you who are younger than 30, who cannot possibly imagine why anyone would have 4 totes of cards and letters, this is before computers, email, cell phones, and social media. Long-distance calls were expensive, so paper and postage stamps is how we communicated. Going through the totes was a joy-filled activity. There was a larger pile of non-family mail to read and then discard. Cards and letters from high school and college friends, from coworkers and UUs. Congratulations on new houses, new jobs, new babies, the adoption. Thank yous for kindness I'd shown or work I had done. Sympathy for losses. Lots of Christmas letters outlining the highlights of their year. Some people I remembered well. Others, I couldn't even remember what they looked like. I viewed each card and letter as a gift, a memory of my connection to lots of very different people, and that they cared enough about me to put pen to paper and a stamp to an envelope. Although I no longer have these actual pieces of paper, the feelings of love, caring, and acceptance continue to bring a smile to my face and a song to my heart. Then there were the cards and letters I kept. From my family, when as the oldest of 4, I went to college first, a little hard for all of us. Love letters from Dan during our long-distance relationship when I was an undergrad and he was in law school. From my dad after he and my mom got divorced. From my new in-laws as we got to know one another. From my daughters, lots of homemade cards, lots of glitter, and lots of letters from camp, though some of those were very short. All of these are a chronicle of them growing up. Then there were the special letters I kept because the authors are no longer alive. Letters from my dad, from his mother, the grandmother I never got to know because she died when I was 3. But she knew me and she called me Little Bits. From my mom's mother, Kitty, who I love dearly, even though she could be very difficult to love. And letters from my dear friend Mark, whose death a few years ago from kidney failure just floored me. All of these cards and letters evoke so many memories for me. They bore witness to who I was then and who I was becoming. They remind me that I never am truly alone, that I love and I am loved. The cards and letters I kept would only fill half a tote, and I'm not getting very many anymore. So I put all of these into two beautiful boxes, very fitting for the treasures they are.
This next piece is from Charlie Tyrell. He's a filmmaker, and he's made a short film about his father. And this piece from the New York Times reflects on that film. It's called My Dead Dad's Porno Tapes. The hidden compartments of household ephemera are seldom discussed among family members. Parents hide the material relics of their individuality in secret alcoves. And kids know exactly where to find these objects. Collections vary. It can be a hidden stash of pot, a series of love letters from an old boyfriend, or in the case of this film, a small collection of VHS pornography. This is what my dad tucked away, hidden in the air ducts of our unfinished basement. All members of the family knew about this, including my brother and my sister. My dad passed away from cancer in 2008 during my second year of film school. Many of his possessions were donated or discarded. Every time I came home, I would come across a new item and spare it from the trash. The crown jewel was my dead dad's porno tapes. I don't know why I kept them. They're tacky and dated. The content is not alluring, but in their own perverse way, they have become a small totem of remembrance. Over time, the tapes begged to be utilized in some creative format. I tried different routes, but they never fit. I conceded that their only cinematic purpose was to be in a film about my dad. But making a film about my dad was beyond my comfort zone. But making art about yourself and your family allows you to turn rumination into work. The daily practices of a filmmaker can become routine, almost mechanical if you're not careful. With this film, I was doing something else. I was spending a year getting to know my dad in an unusual way. I was learning about his life and the things that he did not have time to tell me. I learned to have empathy for a complex man whom I was rather hard on when I was younger. We hold on to our loved ones when they pass. Objects can become talisman, and memories become mythic. Some objects become sacred for no reason and are just as impenetrable as the person who left them. I came to a conclusion during my process. You can't take it with you, but you can pass it on.
Hello, I'm Karen Hirsch, and I'm a UUSS member and a nosy person. I enjoy seeing how other people live. It's one of the reasons I love my side job as a dealer of vintage and antique items. I find most of my merchandise at estate sales, which are typically held after a person dies in the home they had lived in. I can get tunnel vision at an estate sale, viewing the bounty of items available solely as potential inventory, not as the belongings of an actual person. But when I slow down and more closely consider these items, I find they tell me something of the owner's story, leave me curious to know more. In the house filled with feline figurines lived a woman who loved cats. I wonder if she had cats of her own and where they went when she died. In the house with a large room dedicated to a model railroad display lived a man who loved trains. I wonder what train routes he rode during his life, what sights he saw. And there's the perfectly preserved corsage that fell from the pages of a natural history book published in 1882. Who wore it, and at what presumably happy event? I never know what I'm going to find at estate sales. Once I entered a backyard where an antique bedpan collection was on display. Another time, I peered into a bathroom where the wallpaper pattern was a repeated image of a scantily clad go-go dancer. Not long ago, at the bottom of a cedar box of sewing notions I purchased, I found an enormous human molar with all four roots intact. These are the kind of quirky discoveries that evoke a smile and make for good stories to share with friends. There are times, though, when what I see hurts my heart. One home I visited had several bedrooms filled, floor to ceiling, with unopened boxes of dolls. In another house, a musty bedroom with 1970s shag carpet and classic rock posters seemed like a fossilized shrine to a child long departed. I recently found myself in a home whose garage was full of unopened crafting kits, projects that the homeowner, who had died, would now never complete. Another of my vintage ventures is creating greeting cards from antique postcards. Most of the postcards I use are from the earliest years of the 20th century. I usually buy the postcards in large lots and sort through them to find ones in usable condition. Reading these old postcards is like eavesdropping. Sometimes the messages are just banalities, folks discussing food, chores, and weekend plans. Sometimes they are written in other languages, a reminder of our nation's rich immigrant history. Sometimes there's no message at all, just the recipient's name and address. And sometimes the subject matter is quite dramatic. Like in December 1907, when Emily wrote to her friend, "Well, Clara, I'm so sorry for you. I didn't know until last night that Earl was married. Too bad, try again." Some postcards dispense advice. In October 1909, Henry wrote to Chet with birthday guidance, "Behave yourself, but if you can't behave, be careful." Postcards can also tantalize. A February 1910 birthday postcard reads, in its entirety, "If you can guess who this is from, I'll give you a nice big plum." Now and then I find postcards that tell an ongoing story. A series of cards was sent to Miss Jenny Boucher of Akron, Ohio in 1909 from someone who obviously quite taken with her. One message read in part, "I'll take a run down to see you, even if it is only for an hour or two. Jenny, don't forget what I told you. If there is anything I can do for you, don't be afraid to say so." I wonder what became of Jenny and her suitor. Of course, what's most poignant about these antique cards and the estate sale items are that they belong to people who are no longer with us. I can't help but wonder what my belongings will one day say to a stranger about me. My saved correspondence, mostly now emails and texts, my many half-completed abandoned poems, my collection of 1920s advertising tins featuring gorgeous, feisty flappers, the books I meant to read, my own pressed flowers. What will my story be when I am no longer here to tell it?
Our fall service theme is heritage and legacy. And so I was inspired for the theme of the service today, What We Leave Behind. And then I embarked on a reading expedition to read everything that related to this topic that I could find. And it was interesting that some of the self-help articles I found in books like Real Simple or magazines Real Simple and online advice things really start with the implication, the assumption that being attached to things is a problem. So I was pondering that and realizing that it's really only a problem if it's getting in the way of living your life. So if you have so much stuff that it feels like a burden or it imposes on your physical space, if some of the stuff that you have creates guilt or stress for you, or you're spending too much on that storage unit, then maybe your stuff is more of a problem for you than not. But getting rid of stuff is really hard, really hard. This is part of the problem of the attachments that we form to things. Many people at various stages of their lives are in a position that where they're forced to downsize. There's lots of advice in these various books that I read on what to do about downsizing, how to relieve yourself of the burden of your stuff. One of the most popular ones of the past year was called The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up by Marie Kondo, a major, major bestseller, which speaks to this unspoken or maybe spoken need that people have to manage their stuff. So her advice is to do it all at once. Don't do a little bit at a time. Do it all at once. Go by category. Don't go by room. Don't say, I'm going to clean up this room and then that room. I'm going to do my books. I'm going to do my clothes. Go by category. She wants you to focus on what you want to keep rather than what you should discard. It's an interesting little switch. Any of you, I know when I approach downsizing my stuff, I usually start with what I want to discard. She starts with the advice of what you want to keep. But more importantly, her key message is that everything you keep should spark joy. If you look at something and it doesn't spark joy, out it goes. I would call this spiritual and ruthless at the same time. Now, it's a very interesting exercise, and after reading all these books, I'm going to talk about another book in a minute. After reading all these books, of course, I'm sitting there at my desk, I'm looking at my bookshelves, and I'm looking at knickknacks on my bookshelves. And I look at one thing, it's like, I don't remember where I got it. I have no association with it. I get a blank feeling from it. Out it goes. And then the same thing with my books. And I have a lot of books. I've done pretty well. I've managed to, we have an agreement in our house, when a book comes in, a book goes out. So that doesn't mean we're making any progress on the huge piles of books, but we're not making it worse. But glancing at my bookshelf, it was really an emotional exercise. Some of them, I have this sense of like, oh my God, I paid so much money for that book. I can't just make it go away. I haven't looked at it in 2 years, but you know. There's definitely a status component. Some of the books is like, well, a minister should have that book in their collection. And the hardest one, somebody gave it to me. And if I don't like it and I don't want it and somebody gave it to me, it's so hard. Now, this is where hoarders get into trouble. We all know about hoarders, I assume, people who can never get rid of anything or have an unmanageable amount of stuff. And hoarders overly identify with their stuff. A lot of times they can't let go of the potential of what something could be. Maybe that woman in Karen's reflection with the craft gifts. All of those represented a potential project that she may do someday. Hoarders also get very engaged in the security aspect. That's why some hoarders will have 1,000 rolls of toilet paper. I think there's a spectrum here between people who never get attached to anything and can throw things away and hoarders, and we're all somewhere on that spectrum. My mother was a bit of a collector. She had Balik dishes, Toby mugs. I chose a Norman Rockwell plate for the cover of The Order of Service as an homage to my mother's Norman Rockwell plate collection. She also liked to collect kitchen equipment, most of which she never used. Now, my parents had lived independently until their early 90s, but after each one had a significant life-changing fall, they decided to move into a senior home. This was the second time that they downsized. The first time they went from, they downsized by half from the family home that I grew up in, and this time they had to downsize by two-thirds. I was there for the first process, and the lesson I learned was, don't be there for the second process. So I hired someone. I hired someone who specializes in helping people downsize. And this woman sat with my mother, gave her rules, gave her a structure to process all of her things, arranged for the move, arranged to design their new space where everything would go, and then arranged for an estate sale and somebody to make everything go away. Now, I was really glad I wasn't part of that process, and I think maintaining a good relationship with my parents is possible because I wasn't part of that process. It was very painful and stressful for my mother, and she actually got quite ill after the move, I think as the result of the stress, because she did it all in a month. All this downsizing happened in a month. And it was sad for me because so many things that I knew had meaning to her just went away. Went away. Even after they moved, they still had things that didn't fit in their new place. And so as part of my taking care of her, I just took it. I took luggage that they didn't need. I just took it. I either gave it to somebody else or I gave it to Goodwill, but I relieved them of the burden of this excess stuff. But her mother's stuff was the hardest. And that's why I have the museum of my grandmother at my home, because I gave my mother the gift of giving a home to her mother's stuff. Now, if my parents could have taken the advice of Margareta Magnusson, who wrote the book on Donstadding, pardon my Swedish accent, Swedish for death cleaning. This is another one of the best-selling books that have come out recently about managing your stuff. Swedish death cleaning is the idea of freeing yourself from your own clutter in your life and freeing your children from the burden of sorting through your clutter after your death. She advocates making choices now of what you want to keep and what you want to give away, and give it away now, whether it's a treasured item you give to your child. Asking people if they want it. The author suggests that your mid-60s is not too young to begin this process. There's something powerful in that. Deciding for yourself what will define you after your death, how your stuff will reflect you. Something powerful in the idea of not burdening your children with your stuff. But all the books that I read suggest that you do the sentimental things last, especially the photos. These sentimental items can be an intergenerational burden, like my mother's attachment to her mother's things, or parents not wanting to let go of items from their children's youth, like the shrine to the youth that Karen mentioned. But going through your items and processing the sentimental things can be a powerful process, kind of like a life review, like Frances and the letters that she went through. In order to let go of these sentimental objects, you need to feel the feelings, engage with the memories, and integrate them into your own life and your own story. You're releasing them from the object, and then you can let the object go. That thing just becomes an object again. So for better or worse, in this life, we are somewhat defined by what we acquire, what we keep, and what we leave behind. Our possessions represent a history of our life, and in some cases, the lives of the people that came before us. How will the museums of the future represent people from our era? What story is told by the things that you will leave behind when you die?